Siren.
107.3.
And the weather today, highs of 5 degrees centigrade, lows of minus 3 degrees centigrade. The patchy mist will actually clear, which will leave areas of cloud. It'll be a dry day with some sunshine. Present amongst us, and we are approaching that time where, yes, Brexit will actually be a reality. But inevitably, we're still faced with a whole range of questions regarding Britain's exit from the European Union. And a major study by the Freight Transport Association of nearly 500 businesses has revealed a number of interesting and somewhat disturbing facts as far as our economic future is actually concerned. We're delighted to welcome the Deputy Chief Executive Officer of the Freight Transport Association to share shed some light on some of the findings of this survey. That's James Hookham. Good morning, James. How are we?
Good morning, Alex. Yes, good, thank you.
Excellent. Okay, so a lot of us have been saying for quite some time, actually, that yes, these are challenges that are going to be faced by transport and a variety of other things. Nearly half of those surveyed by this Freight Transport Association survey say that there aren't enough skilled British workers to ensure their business runs effectively. And a quarter have said that they found it harder to employ skilled workers since the vote to leave the European Union. This is not looking good for road transport, is it, James?
Well, it's certainly presenting our members with a lot of challenges, Alex. And I think this is all to do with the fact that at the moment we don't know with enough certainty what the situation will be for our workers that come from other parts of Europe after Brexit. Now, we know this is one of the key things that's been talked about in the negotiations between the UK and the European Commission. One of the first things we need is some clarity about this, just to see how big a challenge that we've got. Understandably, people that are quite clearly worried about their future, their families and so on, that they've moved to the UK and are not certain whether they'll be continuing to be able to work in the UK after Brexit, are hedging their bets and perhaps returning to their countries to make sure that they get the best of the jobs that are available there. So it's something that we either got to clarify one way or the other so that everybody knows what the situation is.
Worst case scenario, presumably goods will not be transported by the road from that point of view if we're faced with this, and clearly customers and businesses will suffer accordingly.
Well, there's been a shortage of skilled people in the logistics industry for some time. We've had driver shortages, for example, for our largest trucks of approaching 50,000 for several years now, and that's been made up by a combination of extra overtime and double shifts and so on. So it's something that is been a real problem for the industry for a good many years, and this survey shows just how big that problem could get if the decisions about Brexit go the wrong way.
Our politicians are regularly saying, oh yes, well, it doesn't matter about losing frictionless trade with Europe because we've got frictionless trade with lots of other countries in the world. However, Europe is our near neighbour, and presumably if we're losing that scenario in terms of having to undergo lots of border checks, lots of paperwork, lots of bureaucracy, that's also not going to be a good thing.
Well, indeed. And it's made particularly challenging by the fact that all of our ferry services, especially the services between Dover and Calais, but also the other services, for example, across the Irish Sea, from Holyhead and Liverpool into Dublin and so on, are all based around the fact that it has been frictionless borders for a good many years. And none of the sort of the infrastructure, none of the border staff are in place in order to properly regulate this. Now, this will change because this was a consequence of the decision to leave the customs union, which at the moment provides for this frictionless trade. So there will be changes. And again, our message to the government is, well, can we please have some very early indications about what those sort of changes will be? Because there's a big job for businesses to do in getting ready for Brexit, whenever that may be. But we can't just be expected to respond overnight. We do need a little bit of notice.
Do you ever get frustrated, James, in terms of you see clearly that from any perspective of what one might call rational thought and business thinking, that you need information, you need to know how to plan long term for decisions, that somehow what's happening at Westminster seems to be fudging all kinds of things? And whilst that might be charming in an eccentric vote, actually there are people's livelihoods at stake here.
Well, yeah, that's very true. And part of the job the Freight Transport Association does is to provide a reality check to government about some of its consequences of its decisions and not just in Brexit either. I think logistics and the delivery of goods to shops and premises and indeed to people's homes are poorly understood generally by politicians. And part of the role of the FTA is to make clear to decision makers exactly how important this kind of activity is. As regards our trade with the EU, I think most of our members are accepting there will be change and are up for that challenge. We just need to know as soon as possible the things that are going to need to be done and thought through so we can get ready in time and to make a success of Brexit. There are a lot of members that want this to work and want it to work well, but they can only do that with the right information at the right time.
So return briefly to the logistics sector and the notion of that. You mentioned clearly one of the challenges in terms of getting skilled workers is that actually there's an ever diminishing pool of talent, it would seem. Are there any strategies that firms are actually developing to actually recruit more skilled workers in terms of training them and developing them and so on?
Yes, and the FTA supports a lot of those activities right across the country. Obviously, our major target is young people, our next generation of managers and workers. And we work with an organisation called Career Ready that promotes contacts with schools and colleges, offers career advice, and in particular develops some curricula and courses, qualifications, in colleges of further education that will prepare people for a career in logistics. We also promote something that's unsurprisingly called Think Logistics, that is particularly directed at younger people at school. And this offers the opportunity for our members to go to schools and to talk to groups of school children about what logistics does and how, in our view, it could be a really exciting job for them if that's what they want to do.
You mentioned, James, that we're looking to hopefully have a positive outcome for Brexit, and I think that tends to be the rhetoric that tends to be used frequently. How realistic is that? I mean, if we're having this interview in, say, 2 years from now, when obviously the Brexit thing will have happened, we'll be moving into 2020 then. Best guess, would you say, actually we'll muddle through somehow?
Well, I think we'll do more than muddle through, Alex. I think this is what the logistics industry is going to do for the country, because Brexit, first and foremost, affects the free movement of goods between the UK and the EU. And I know that our members that are involved in that will work really hard to make sure that consumers and their customers, the business customers, don't notice any change because of Brexit. That's not necessarily meaning it's going to be easy. It's probably going to be quite tough. But I know that there will be a lot of people working a lot of hours in order to keep the goods flowing, to keep Britain trading, and to ensure that the process remains as smooth, if a little different to what it is now, so that very few people actually notice the difference. We might not get it all right, but there will be plenty of people aiming for that outcome.
It must make a bit of a change not to at least be complaining about fuel prices, although that's another issue we can actually go into on another programme entirely.
Don't start me off.
Exactly, no, precisely, because it's just, again. If people are looking to find out more details about the survey and indeed some of the things we've spoken about today, presumably the fta.co.uk website would be the best place to go to as far as the Freight Transport Association is concerned.
It certainly is, and also search for Think Logistics as well. That's probably another good source, particularly if you're at school or in college and thinking you're looking for a good, challenging career over the next few years.
James, it's been delightful speaking with your good self. I get a sense that actually we'll get there in the end, but it's going to be a bit of a, well, what is it, the old sort of line is that actually don't think about the end destination, think about the journey. It's the journey that's the important thing.
Indeed, and as we advise all our drivers, strap in and hold on tight. So here we go.
Commodores with Flying High, possibly not the best tune to actually listen to if you are afraid of flying. As we were talking about in the first part of the programme with Ian Lennox, over 21 million British folk are more scared of flying than compared with 10 years ago. Let's do a quick straw poll in the studio. Tessa, are you afraid of flying?
I'm not afraid, but I think it's always in your back of the mind that something could happen, I suppose.
Something could happen.
Yeah.
Eva MacDonald, welcome to the show, by the way, Eva.
Hello.
What about your thoughts on flying? Because you've travelled to Cuba, you've travelled to... Canary Islands, a whole range of things. So in terms of that, presumably you didn't take the boat, you did fly. Were you afraid?
We did fly, yes. Well, I really like flying, just because it's that asset of travelling, and I'm a massive fan of travelling, but there is that thought. Yeah.
And you don't think about plane crashes, disappearances, alien abductions, terrorist attacks, no?
No, there is that thought at the back of your mind, as Tessa says.
Well, to begin to start talking about exactly that thought in the back of your mind, who better than aviation safety investigator extraordinaire, the fabulous David Gleave. How are you, David?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
Well, we're on the ground, so that's okay. Yeah, we're working here. We're obviously flying as the Earth is spinning around the solar system and so on. But as far as we're concerned, we are standing still. Now, this air crash investigation on National Geographic, airing every Thursday at 9 p.m. It's not going to help, is it? Really, in terms of if people are a bit concerned about flying, these kind of things might just sort of say, "Oh, it's all terrible."
I think one of the first things that the programmes do is to show you the depth that we go to as investigators to uncover what really has gone on so that we can learn all the lessons from it from all around the world. I mean, we've got a whole variety of programmes coming up, none of them involving British Airlines flying off towards Ibiza for your holiday or something like that. So we're finding more and more things in sort of freight areas. We've got space aeroplane crashes in this one, test flights and demonstration flights. Obviously, people are aware of Malaysia 17 that was shot down and things like that. But essentially, I think watching the programs gives you an idea of the tremendous detail that anything up to 50 to 60 investigators can go into for up to a year, even 2 years for some of these investigations, and how we distribute the information around the world.
Hollywood obviously would not be Hollywood without its focus on the disastrous nature of airline travel, and the whole TV series Lost was primarily based on issues relating to that. But as we look through the 21st century, we've got cyber security. Your flight systems could be hacked into. We could have drone collisions. Are these viable fears, or are people again worrying needlessly, David?
I mean, there was a report published about hacking into an aircraft flight system. That was just one of the communication systems. It's not related to how the aeroplane flies. So essentially, that it would make no difference whatsoever if you started to get false information sent along through a satellite communication system. The crew should be able to spot that pretty quickly and wouldn't respond to it. Even if they do respond to it, then another message will come back from air traffic control saying, what are you doing and why are you doing that? So I think we have to discount the sort of everything can be hacked and we're going all off to Diego Garcia for our holidays unexpectedly. So I'm not worried about that one.
Well, not that there's anything wrong with Diego Garcia, just in case we were wondering. I mean, quite clear. Yeah, it's just a thought, though.
Nobody's found Malaysia 370 on that island at the moment. Mm. But when it comes to things like drone strikes, there are two separate areas. One is the unintentional drone strike, where somebody is flying their toy aeroplane around an airport and doesn't realise that aeroplanes are flying in that area. It would cause damage, but it won't actually cause the aircraft to crash. So it's an inconvenience in that somebody flying an aeroplane off Heathrow would cause the traffic to stop for a while until they stopped you from flying your toy drone around, but it wouldn't actually cause an aeroplane to crash. The use of them for terrorism is a totally separate issue, but in general that's not really going to affect us in this country, and that's up to the security services to keep that under control. I'm not going to give you an expert's guide as to how to bring down an aeroplane with a drone, but I don't think we should be too worried about it. It's a major inconvenience, but it isn't actually going to cause significant damage for a small toy drone being flown by a child off, in a park off the end of a runway somewhere.
I was always taught that any landing you can walk away from is a good one, but that's perhaps a bit too pessimistic on life. Eva, questions from yourself?
Oh, sorry, I've got...
Choking with emotion of the whole thing there. So
okay.
We'll allow Eva to gather her composure for a moment. Tessa, thoughts from yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I find this all very interesting, and especially when you hear flights sort of just disappearing, and sort of when people talk about the Bermuda Triangle and all of that. I mean, how in-depth are these investigations? How do you go about this and finding missing planes?
The first thing that we do is fit the aeroplanes with something called an emergency location transmitter, an ELT. That should deploy and actually start to broadcast information up to satellites that go around the globe So we should be able to find an aeroplane anywhere in the globe within about 40 minutes. That's how long it takes between the satellites passing overhead. That's for almost all of the globe, not over the polar ice caps, but for the rest of the world, we have this system. About half the time it works when there's an accident, the locator beacon will go off. Beyond that, we obviously have air traffic control following commercial flights, so there's various reporting points that they interact with air traffic control. We have radar, and then we have automatic broadcasting from the aeroplane that can be picked up. So to some extent, it depends how technically complex the aeroplane is and how much money the airline is willing to pay for the data to be transmitted up via the satellite.
Okay, and obviously in the news we hear about all the major plane disappearances and things like this. Do you have a lot behind the scenes that go on that we don't hear about, that you find? Is there a lot that goes on behind the scenes that we sort of don't hear about in the news?
I think one of the reasons that people may be becoming more fearful of flying is the fact that you're now hearing about all of the accidents you never used to hear about. So if a plane crashes in Colombia, it wouldn't have appeared on the news previously. It would have appeared in the trade press a week later, and you might have got a picture 2 weeks later of an aeroplane in the hillside. But now with satellite communications and things, you can get TV crews out to various areas and point a camera up a hill, or even locals with mobile phones will download it to the internet and things like that. So it's actually quite rare not to get a lot of press coverage related to almost every accident. And there's a lot of websites that the public can go to now and track all of these things. So I think public awareness of aircraft accidents is increasing, but public awareness of the lack of risk of getting on an aeroplane isn't.
Right, okay, that would make sense.
We've minimised our risk within the studio. We've given Eva the Heimlich manoeuvre, so she's okay.
Thank you.
Eva, thoughts for yourself?
Well, is there, because as you say, you do lots of different ways of checking aeroplane safety and things. Is there one safety check that's I don't know how to put
common
it.
Common to the whole thing.
That's easier to use. Yeah.
Is the engine going to fall off?
Is there one that's looked at more and is more main than other ones?
Well, I think what we're trying to do at the moment is to minimise the chance of an accident, and then if an accident does occur, to increase the survivability. So a lot of people think, well, there's no point sort of looking at the safety instruction card because I'm going to die if there's an accident. That's completely false. Yes, I'll admit that if you go into the side of a mountain, much like the Sukhoi jet in Program 5 of the series does, then it's all over and done with. But if you're going to have an accident around the airport, and that's where most of them are, then they are highly survivable. We get a lot of aeroplanes across the globe over a year, about 20 or so, fall off a runway. Very, very few people are killed, if any, when you fall off a runway. So people have this big fear from Hollywood of an engine failure and things like that. But again, we've addressed that. The engines are so powerful that you can fly with one engine having failed. I think some of it is public reassurance. What's coming up in the future, I can see that we're going to do more pilot training to do with how to handle normal routine things that go on, standard failures that we get that haven't been trained very well. So we're gradually sort of closing all of the doors down, which is why the statistics are getting better year on year.
Do you think as we head towards an era with driverless cars, we'll surely be having driverless planes as well?
Oh, wow. That would be good.
Yes, it's quite possible to do it. We've been able to fly aeroplanes on their own since about the 1970s. What we haven't actually got sorted out is how to taxi them from the end of the runway back to the gate and park it.
That could be a question of artificial intelligence having to work for its money.
I mean, aviation is fascinating. I think it's a fascinating subject, and there's a lot to learn about it.
Well, 100 years ago.
I still find it amazing you can get, a big plane up in the air. I've always thought
I think that's amazing.
It's incredible.
Indeed, it's almost unnatural. But still, I won't say anything about if God had wished us to fly, he would have given us wings, because we are celebrating the centenary of the RAF, actually, which is all great stuff there this year, so it's all good. Yeah. Clearly, National Geographic is the channel to go to find out about air crash investigation and so on, but are there any other areas for folk who might not have that on their subscription package of systems to go to? Where can people go to, David, to find out more information about air safety and so on?
There's quite a few websites dedicated to aviation safety. Obviously, Mr. Wikipedia is quite a good place to start. Oh. If you type in there, there's lots of links through to all the accidents.
But has it been academically approved, David? You know, the Wikipedia thing. We don't know where we're going on that one. You could have any sorts of alien people putting up suffer.
Well, yes, but it'll provide you a link through to things like the National Transportation Safety Board for in America, or the United Kingdom Air Accidents Investigation Branch. If you look under investigation, then there's usually the first link on Wikipedia will then take you through to the official accident report. Embry-Riddle University in the United States, that they have a full set of American accident reports. The .gov.uk website has all the British accident reports on it. And then after that, there's quite a few sites telling you the statistics, as we've done here with the surveys, to show you sort of what people are worried about, and then why you shouldn't be worried about it. You know, there's anxiety.com has some things to try and alleviate your fear of flying if you're in the United States. So there's all sorts of information out there, but it's just a question of trying to filter the false information from the real experts and giving their you know, proper comments and trying to reassure people.
And David, that is where you have demonstrated your expertise this morning, why we shouldn't actually avoid certain seats on a flight, and why we actually take more sort of notice of the air crash survival rates and so on. Have you had a reasonably interesting and safe telephonic link with us this morning?
It's been great. Thank you very much indeed.
So can we look forward to hopefully connecting with you again in the not-too-distant future and keeping us appraised of how aviation safety is improving, and we shouldn't worry about things. Will you return?
Absolute pleasure. Anytime.
Looking from a window above, it's like a story of a dream. Can you hear me? Came back only yesterday, moving further away. Won't you hear me? All I needed was the love you gave. All I needed for another day. And all I ever knew, only you. Sometimes when I think of your name, and it's only a game, and I need you. Listening to the words that you sing, getting harder to sing. When I see you, all I needed was the love you gave. All I needed for another day. Touch of your hand behind a closed door. All I needed was the love you gave. All I needed for another day. And all I ever knew, only you.
Singer, scholar, festival ambassador, and midweek drivette. it's Eva MacDonald on the Midweek Drive.
Yay. Okay, so we have a little revelation to make now, folks.
Okay.
For the listener who probably is not aware of this, but Tessa, you were saying that you go to the same Zumba class as Eva MacDonald.
Yes,
we do.
Oh, of course, we've just heard the ident why Rachel Abbott sitting next to you in the studio, choking with emotion over aircraft and aviation safety investigating scenario. So how did this start, this crazy, wilder, wacky way of actually...
We never knew it.
We never knew. Well, I've always wanted to go, and I was talking to my flatmate, Chloe, and we've been wanting to go since we started uni, but mm-hmm. never made that. I don't know, we just never got round to it. And then all of a sudden, one day she said to me, well, I've got my car, let's go. And she found this really good class at the Yarborough Leisure Centre in Lincoln. And we go every Monday now. And I just so happened to bump into Eva, didn't I?
Oh no, it's crazy.
So who knew?
You're too young to remember clearly the days of the 80s where leotards were very much the fashion. Your mums might remember this. Yeah. And Olivia Newton-John and Jane Fonda.
See, I love that era. I think that's really,
I thought that was brilliant. Start wearing leotards.
Not that I was there, but...
past life.
Yeah.
reincarnated. In terms of costume, are leotards still in, or do you still have leg warmers? Or is it a case of, no, we actually sort of have to wear full hazmat suits?
They're not really around anymore. I remember...
Not really, are they?
I do remember, I think, it was a fad to wear leg warmers when I was at school. It did come back, but not so much now, is it?
We had leg warmers as a fashion when I was in school.
Yeah.
But, I don't think they're worn very much.
No. There was probably parties where you'd go, like an 80s theme, where you could, wear all the neon colours.
So leg warmers not used in Zumba.
No.
Ugg boots presumably also not
literally
there.
Just gym wear, isn't it, really?
Yeah, right. I just go in any gym
normal
clothes.
Gym wear.
And would you recommend it for anyone, or would you say no, unless you actually have immaculate physical poise and perfection, just don't go there?
No.
Anyone,
I'd recommend it, yeah.
Anyone.
Yeah, our class is very mixed, isn't it?
Yeah.
A very mixed age group. And also, our teacher's really good, our dance teacher.
Yeah, she's
and really, if you if you can't do the moves, she just says, make up your own. And she always asks, doesn't she, if anybody's got an injury at the beginning, which I guess is kind of procedure. So, yeah, anybody really.
Does and I have made the dance move sometimes.
Yeah.
Because you don't know what you're doing. You have made up. You have self-choreographed.
Well, you don't know what you're doing sometimes.
Sometimes you just... you just have to keep going, don't you, throughout the hour. And you can go get a drink when you want and you can stop if you can't keep up. But obviously our teacher goes on for the full hour.
Mm.
I suppose it just depends. It depends on your stamina. But yeah, anybody can attend really, can't they?
Yeah, they can. Yeah.
So you'd recommend it then?
Definitely.
Definitely.
And the music's good.
Is it?
Music's great.
Music's
I
really
love
good.
The music.
You love the music, yeah.
I will not be going.
Okay. I think you should sign up.
I'm just in case people are wondering, where's he going with this? I will not be. It's not my intention. Unless we're talking a six-figure incentive here. I might go. But no, other than that, no. It's just very
but
good.
But for any of the listeners that want to try it, I'd
say,
recommend it.
So, Zumba.
Zumba. It's quite... It's like cultural dance, isn't it?
It is.
It's a mixture
of.
There's a bit of ballet in there, a bit of Spanish flamenco,
bit of Rhiannon, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, there's a bit of everything in there.
There
it's,
is.
It's quite. It's good. Yeah.
Very good.
are the opening bars and chords of China Crisis, of course, Loi, leading into the next extraordinary feature in which we talk about the Far East, and indeed the fact that nearly a quarter of British folk have admitted that visiting the Far East is something they want to do by the end of 2018. As we actually head into the Year of the Dog, clearly we need to explore the reasons why we're not actually making these long-haul journeys, and to address that we've got travel expert extraordinarily fabulous Wendy Wu with us. Good morning, Wendy. How are you? Excellent. So share with us, Wendy, this particular aspect about 50% of Brits have never visited the most popular UNESCO World Heritage sites. So we're talking about terracotta warriors, the Great Wall of China, Taj Mahal in India. Is it just at the end of the day, we're just a little bit timid and we say, actually, we prefer to stick with what we know, if that might be a week in Skegness or possibly the Costa del Sol?
Yes, I think that British are very, very good travellers. And they are very adventurous. But they don't go to the UNESCO World Heritage Site. It's possibly because they are busy with somewhere else. And also that they wait for the right time. And as you can see from the study which we currently just conducting, then this is change. So therefore, about 22% of the people saying that they are going to go, it's on their plan, and 50% said they are going to do it even sooner.
Now, the terracotta warriors, clearly one of those wonderful, I suppose, heritage of the whole of mankind, really, present there. 2,200-year-old terracotta warriors. They're going on a show in Liverpool as part of an exhibition showcasing the largest haul of early Chinese treasures. But in terms of, you can see them in this country, but perhaps there's no reason, there's nothing that can compare, presumably, Wendy, to actually going and seeing them in their original location.
I totally agree with you. However, I do want to share with you that the First Emperor and the Terracotta Warriors show in the Liverpool Museum is fantastic too. So I would highly recommend that all the people go to see it because it's stunning. The original in Xi'an is fantastic, but the one in Liverpool is different, the visually stunning, and you get up closer personal with the warriors, and you almost can touch it. So I would highly recommend you and your listener to go to see it, and of course, after you see it, you will be fascinated by it, and then you must go to China and to Xi'an to see the original thing. And Wendy Wittos will absolutely take you there because we actually were at the opening of the show in Liverpool, and we brought the governor of Shanxi province, and we were there for the whole day events. It was fantastic. The show is very different from the one in Xi'an. So I would say that if you already see the ones in Xi'an, still go to Liverpool because you get to be so close to it. But if once you see, you have seen the Liverpool one, then you must go to Xi'an because the one in Xi'an is so big and so, so original.
Who would have thought we'd be connecting Liverpool with China? Extraordinary. Wendy, were you surprised by any of the findings that the survey actually revealed? I mean, was there anything which you thought, well, that's unusual? I mean, because the reverse might be the case. The citizens of China who might sort of have been tempted to actually come and see the Tower of London, for instance.
Yes. I was a little surprised because, as I mentioned earlier, I always thought Brits are explorers of the world, very adventurous. So I was surprised that 50% have not seen the UNESCO World Heritage. However, things are changing, the trends are changing, and now the world is getting smaller, and British people are traveling further afield, especially the relationship between UK and China has entered into a golden era. And so therefore, for example, Wendy Tours have just formed a partnership with Shanxi Province Tourism. And so we are actually doing a very big event to celebrate the Year of Tourism for China and the UK. And 1,000 British visitors will be invited to a grand, spectacular national event in Xi'an. So all of this will help to incentivize the visitors in UK to travel to China this year. And also there's more airline coming as well. And for example, at Wendy Tours, we actually offers free business upgrade right now. And think about it. Everybody flies from UK to Asia, 12 hours on a flight. I'm sure that when you come to the airplane, you will want to experience the business class for once. And right now, yeah, we have these very few seats for still left for you to actually have free business upgrade.
Well, I mean, Wendy, that's a very, very tempting offer, because clearly turning right as opposed to turning left can be critical to the whole notion of actually boarding the plane. Are you finding in terms of age that some of our sort of under 20s or teenagers, or indeed sort of early 20s folk, are kind of getting used to this? Because I know some of my students at the University of Lincoln were very excited that they were travelling off to the Far East and doing various visits over there from that point of view. Is it a generational thing that perhaps, or is it a case of no, it's actually across all generations from 20 through to the 80s?
It's 100% across the generation and across all segments. And that also study shows, because China and Japan, for example, it's a more expensive destination in the past. So therefore, students normally don't have the budget, and younger people lack of time. But however, as mentioned, right now is more airline available, and also travel is become easier, become more affordable. So young people wanting to go, but the mature travelers, especially, they have the time, they can afford it, and they have been to all the other places in the world. So their appetite for the Far East is far greater. So therefore, yeah, for example, at Wendy Tours, we have a majority of our customer are actually mature travelers, and yeah, they are major segment. So therefore, lots of our work is to make sure they get the best look after.
Which is excellent. And again, you're very tempting proposition there, Wendy. I've never actually been over to the Far East myself, but clearly you sort of have put together a very, very worthwhile case from that perspective. How can people find out further information about Wendy Wu Tours? What's the best website to go to, and so on?
First of all, we would like to take you there if you have when you have some time. That's the first thing. And secondly, please visit our website, which is wendywutours.com.uk. So it's wendywutours.co.uk, has all the information. And also, yeah, just give us a call, because our people are very knowledgeable. We are absolutely specialist. And so we will be able to help you guys to go there. Doesn't matter if it's a group tour or it's tailor-made, customized. We do everything. We have adventure tour. We have immerse yourself. Yeah, just as long as you want to go to China or Asia, then we are the one, and we are there to look after you.
Well, clearly, as we head into the year of the dog, and I'm not sure, I think it's supposed to be fairly auspicious for a variety of reasons, we look forward to connecting again with you. Wendy, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us yourself this morning? Has it been okay for you?
Yes, it has been very, very good morning. Yes.
Well, this is good. So hopefully we can connect again in the very near future, and we'll talk more about the fantastic work that you're actually doing with respect to Wendy Wu Tours. And yes, moving into not just seeing it on television, not just seeing it on the internet, not just seeing it on the screen, but perhaps actually being there yourselves and actually seeing that whole thing, and obviously take advantage of the exhibition at Liverpool as well. Wendy, we salute you. Take care. We'll hopefully speak again very soon.
Thank you so much. It's great speaking with you.
Another place, another time searching for that something that I can't.
Oh, there's only so much China black you can take on a morning. Wendy Wu there, discussing tourism in China. Would you consider going to China, Eva?
I would. I've never been so far, but it's somewhere up on my bucket list.
Tessa's going up to Newcastle on March the 9th, so who knows, you could go to China.
Yeah, I'll just leave Sunnydale, Black Bite. I'm going off.
I'm off.
I'm off.
And sometime this year, we'll hopefully be looking at doing some outside broadcast reports in Edinburgh as well, as, of course, the Lincolnshire Countryside Links thing and so on.
Yes.
And so forth. All great stuff there. Well, what do we do now with a matter of 9.5 minutes to actually go for the programme? Do we actually sort of provide both yourself, Tessa, and Eva,
yes,
with the favourite tune of all time when it comes to Zumba dancing?
Oh, yes.
Oh, all right, then. Go on.
Yay.
To answer your question, were Eva and Tessa doing their Zumba routine whilst listening to Bananarama and Venus? No. But they were talking about it.
Well, they had almost thought about it.
Yeah, it was almost there.
We were discussing it, actually.
The pose. You were. It will happen. Yeah, probably.
It will.
Yeah,
talking
next week
through.
Sometime. Yeah. members of Bananarama, would you like to name all three?
Oh my gosh, I cannot remember off the top of my head. It's bad, isn't it? I cannot remember.
And I listened.
No, I know. It's
Sarah,
awful of me.
Siobhan,
that's
Karen.
It. There you go.
Karen, Siobhan.
Shame
Sarah.
On me. I used to listen to them. My mum used to play it in the car a lot, the album. And I love Bananarama.
Well, there we are. With or without Siobhan. Of course, she's back together with them now, but they had a bit of falling out for a time. So.
Yeah. It's weird.
Anyway,
So all the originals.
Still to come as far as Siren Radio is concerned. Lots of great music. And we've got Chris Clarkson back with the Drive Time show this Thursday, followed by Past Prologue, which we're actually recording this afternoon with Finn Pollard, and a whole manner of things from a historical perspective, considered from a contemporary perspective. Quite fascinating. It's your slot for Sound and Country Vision, of course, that slots
into. Past Prologue. That's all right.
And Sound and Country Vision itself will be returning in the very near future, one presumes.
Yes, yeah, very soon, I think. Short break, but it will be back.
Exactly.
We'll definitely be back.
Stuff there. Eva, will you be back with us?
Yes, of course, I can
Excellent.
Be.
We certainly thank Richard Fitzwilliams, Ian Lennox, James Hookham, David Gleave, and Wendy Wu for spending some time guiding us through the last couple of hours here on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition. We're going up to the news with Ray featuring Mr. Easy and Decline.
Okay.
Well, extraordinary. So that's
there we go.
It's a way forward. Yeah, a little smidgen of Zed featuring Marin Morrison Gray as well.
Oh, yes. Ooh. I like that one.
Well, that's coming through too. So, Eva McDonald, Tessa Snort, and to you, dear listener, farewell. Can we wrap up by saying, well, it's been a travel show, so let's do this little Chinese ni hao.
Okay.
Ni hao.
Ni hao.
Ni hao.